We are?
Yes.
Oh, my God, we're on without even knowing it. I'm telling you, I've been... Hey, folks, welcome to another edition of Smart Talk. Al Bergeson here with Robin Hiller. And glad to have you. I have an exciting show today. However you're listening to us, it's great to have you with us. Our guests today are Professor Sally Marsden from the U of A and Moses Thompson, also from the U of A and the Tucson Unified School District. Before we get started talking to them, I want to begin the show with a thought of the day. That is something that has come up in recent news, and we'll see if we can get a little commentary going here from my guests. As you may know, Joe Biden has announced that he is in the presidential race. And a lot of people are saying, A, is Joe too old? B, is Joe just average Joe? Joe was lost twice before. He's tried. He seems just sort of ordinary. Room temperature IQ is a little strong. I won't say that. But here's a thought. It may actually be his strength. That is, if the country has reached some point where it wants a return to normalcy, it may be not the candidate with the Green New Deal, not the candidate for universal health care, not the candidate for no and for impeachment, because all of that will seem like more change. But the irony of ironies will be that that which led Joe to fail before might actually be that which leads Joe to actually go to the White House. Now, at the same time, this is very early. He's just announced. We will revisit this issue in the future, but I wanted to toss it out. Is there any evidence for this? Let me just mention one thing. Again, it's way too early, but if you think about the top three polling Democrats so far, two of them are sort of just me, ordinary, nice, plain, and the other is Bernie. That is, as the polls stand now, Biden's number one, Bernie's number two, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, South Bend?
Yeah.
I keep saying West Bend, South Bend, Indiana. The Mayor Pete, don't have articulated a program so much. Biden just got started, but they're both sort of running on nice, ordinary. I suppose Beto, too, a little, doesn't have anything going for him other than I'm Beto, and et cetera, as opposed to the more specific program folks. So in some sense, two or three of the leaders so far, maybe it's just name recognition, fair enough, are on a kind of tranquility thing. Anyway, that was an idea I wanted to toss out. Any response by our guests and Robin?
I like the idea of you saying that Bernie is on a tranquility.
No. He isn't. Two of the three. I just meant Mayor Pete and Bernie's got a hard program about, you know, universal health care, et cetera, et cetera. Two of the three leaders are
Mayor Pete
and now Biden seem not to be for any specific thing they may come to later. That is, they're not for rocking the boat for this, that, and the other thing. They're just sort of for, oh, no. Say being nice. I've gotten so cynical now. I can't even talk about normalcy without sort of putting it down.
Well, what Biden's known for is his moderation and his off-the-cuff remarks, and I don't know if that's enough to get him in. But my feeling is one of the problems we have with Democrats, as soon as someone announces, the others, ourselves, the other Democrats, start attacking that person. And this is something that Democrats, I think, have done for years. Mo Udall used to have a saying about it. When Democrats form a firing squad, they stand in a circle. And that is what we continue to do. So as soon as Elizabeth Warren announces, there's like all this Twitter world and newspaper articles from the left attacking her. Whoever gets in, the other Democrats start attacking them. And I think this is a very bad strategy.
Yes, I absolutely agree. What was the first point you said? Do you remember? Doesn't matter. But the point was Trump got elected on a similar kind of thing. No one thought he had a chance, or he was very, that was an off the cuff. The Donald was very much off the cuff. And everyone thought, oh my God. And so that may not be as strange as you think. On the other side,
It could be that he didn't win the electoral vote. I mean, he won the electoral vote, but not the popular vote. And also, I've heard this thing that he might have had help from outside agencies and outside countries.
Yeah, I know, it's fine. But someone who's never run for office, who has all this baggage that still he could vote that he could win an election and that the party of Roosevelt could somehow lose the white working class. I mean, oh my God, it's time for all of us to look in the mirror instead of finding excuses for why Trump won.
I also think there's this, I remember years ago when I was driving to Phoenix all the time, Bush was running against Al Gore. And the description of Al Gore, I listened to stations with a particular point of view, and people felt that Al Gore was a smarty pants. That was the word they would use. And they were annoyed by the smarty pants person. And they felt George Bush was a regular guy. And he was the kind of guy you could go and get a beer with. Well, the problem is, A, he's running for the leadership of the free world. And also, he was a recovering alcoholic. So there was no beer involved in that. But they still felt that there was a regular guy. And after that talk, that all those calls, this guy said, the host said, you know, it'd be a really good idea is if we quit having elections and we just throw people's names in, whoever wants to get elected, Donald Trump, you know, your neighbor who feels all dogs should be muzzled. And that they would just pick it because there is a portion of our population that does not feel that being president takes any skill. And that's, I think, a number of the Trump supporters, is that it does not take any skill to be president.
Yes. Well, you know, all I would say on the other side of that, echoing Thomas Frank in his wonderful book, Listen, Liberal, is that folks may vote for someone like that, but there's a reason that we don't hear their pain, that we don't talk about the opiate crisis, that we don't talk about their unemployment, that we don't talk about their being sort of left behind as the bi-coastal regions of America prosper with globalization. And when they throw a shoe through the window, when they pick someone like that, when the Congress has been deadlocked for a quarter of a century and nothing gets done about them, and that there, some of the counties that voted for Trump actually have a rising mortality rate, that is. And in fact, the white mortality rate of death is now coming up to almost meeting African-American, meaning to be white in America, you have a death rate similar to all the poverty that has been historically associated with the inner city and whatnot and whatnot. That all we talk about is that they are lightweights, that they don't really know what matters. We pay no attention to them, and we lose. We lose over 1,000 office holders at local and state elections during the Obama thing, and we still don't hear it. We still call them idiots. We still call them racist. They may, but I think we need to hear and think about them and what is their problems if we want to go. And the thing about we won the popular vote, it's like coming to a baseball game in a football uniform and saying, hey, I scored more touchdowns. They said, what are you doing? It's baseball. It's been an electoral college since day one. Anyone who goes in thinking, I want to win the popular vote and pays no attention to the electoral vote, anyone who doesn't do the upper Midwest where the historical Democrats are, doesn't even campaign up there, and then says, well, I got more total, isn't that football uniform in a baseball game? It's the wrong thing. Obviously, I have had some coffee this morning and am doing a little
So what should people do differently here this time?
Pardon?
What's your view, what is your advice for people to do differently this time?
Take into account those areas we lost. Take into account some of the issues that drive these people. I used to say Trump won on the issues, and no one would believe me. So I'll take a test of all of you right here. I think you're all good liberals. Let me ask you, one, do you think companies who keep their profits overseas ought to forcefully, if necessary, be brought to bring them back? Okay, never mind that. Number two, do you think if the
Hold
Europeans...
On. Yes.
What?
Okay. Yes. Go with
okay,
the next question.
I did the classic academic response when I give them this little quiz. Do you think the Europeans who aren't paying what NATO percent they should pay for their defense should be made to do it or should be pressured to do it? And they'll also go, Do you think Japan, as the third largest economy in the world, should also pay more for its defense? All I'm trying to say is that there were some specific issues that resonated with parts of the population that we didn't take seriously, and that someone lost an election and need to think more seriously about that. Okay, I think we're getting ready for a break here, but here's one thing I want to say. Please stick with us, because right after this break, we're going to tell you about something that's going on in 24 of Tucson's K-12 schools that you probably don't know anything about. Our two guests are going to fill us in on that. We're back. Welcome back to Smart Talk. And our guests today are Professor Sally Marston from the U of A and Moses Thompson from TUSD and also from the U of A. So I mentioned that there were things going on in 24 schools in Tucson, K through 12, you know, elementary, high school, that you may not know about. So I'm going to pop the question to you guys. What is going on?
So with us, what's going on is gardens. We have started a program now almost 10 years old where we support school gardens in Title I schools in 24 of them in multiple ways through university students. We train to support the gardens and support the teachers to use the gardens for experiential learning and through outreach to schools that are too far away for our students to get to. So in those schools, we provide program coordinators to go and teach the teachers directly how to use the garden.
Moses.
Yeah.
That's a great, that's such a great lead. Moses, part to see. Give us some information here.
Yeah, so it's a really exciting partnership between the Tucson Unified School District and the University of Arizona, where I think through school gardens, we are able to fill a need on both sides. So on the university side, for all of the university students that go out and work in school gardens, they're connecting with the community. They get this service learning opportunity, internship opportunity to work in communities that they might not otherwise connect with. And then on the Tucson Unified side, it's an opportunity to provide enrichment and to provide a stable workforce for schools that want to have school gardens. And school gardens do all kinds of great things.
I'm sure they do. Let me just jump in for here for a quick second. Some folks might be wondering, and I know a lot of low-income areas or schools are also where you guys are active. Of all the things we need today to get kids better educated, to get them up to speed on reading, writing, and arithmetic, why do we need to have them doing gardening? We're no longer an agricultural society. We all go to the market. What's the specific reason or hook that goes with gardening and helping kids in school?
So it's a pretty loaded question. I think we could approach it from a number of angles. I'll just say that I think you mean by the Tucson community, maybe we don't need gardens, but we have them. Teachers like the idea of gardens. They feel that gardens are an opportunity to take their children outside, to help them learn about where their food comes from, to get them out of doors into more structured activity rather than running around in a playground. So those gardens are there, and teachers have been wanting to have gardens for a long time. And we now have a lot of research on the impacts of gardens on kids, everything from social and emotional development to understanding nutrition, to learning to be work in groups, to make collaborative decisions, to manage themselves better. And I think Moses can talk very specifically about the social and emotional effects of gardens in his role as a school counselor.
I think the other thing I would add is it's 2019. Like, why are we still saying, take your textbooks out, today we're gonna learn how to graph? You know, like, we know that's not effective. And so what the garden does is say, hey, by using math, by using science, by keeping records, we can collect data that will help us grow food better. We can collect data, and we can display that data in certain ways that show us patterns. Like, and so that's just a much more engaging way to work with students, where you lead with the context instead of trying to lead with the academic content that the kids have no connection to.
So a lot of traditional educational, the reading, writing, arithmetic stuff I talked about before, can get accomplished through doing this. I know you guys had a survey, and one of the results that struck me, I'd like you to talk about it for a second, was that students said 64% of them, I think in elementary schools, the garden program made them want to come to school. That's pretty fantastic. So I think just on an enrollment basis, so you could talk a little about how having them spend some time in the garden, is this after school or during school? Could maybe talk a little about that, but how that seems to really be working on retention problems in schools.
So one of the, if not the key, the keystone for success for educational success is wanting to be at school. And if a school garden can do that, then the likelihood that there will be academic success, however that's measured, in a school is higher, because students actually want to be there. It's not the thing that they don't want to do that day or any other day. So just having a space where students learn in a kind of self-directed way. I mean, we developed curriculum for teachers to use. We train our interns from the university to take the expertise that they're gaining in their own classes and translate that into lesson plans that they can do out in the garden, everything from kind of speech therapy to art to soil science. They're out there learning by doing. And the literature, the research literature also says that experiential education is not just like, we don't expect students to spend their entire day in the garden. What they do in the garden complements, enhances, enriches what they're doing in the classroom. And that's those standardized tests that can become very dry, very difficult in the sense for students to attach themselves to, especially students in 2019. They come alive in the garden in ways that they don't otherwise from a textbook.
So,
oh, go ahead, Moses.
I was just going to jump in with something really specific.
Great.
So I'm kind of an accidental gardener. I started as a counselor. My background is counseling. And the only reason I garden is because of what garden does for my counseling. And so I started at Monzo Elementary School back in 2006. And one of my jobs as the counselor was to target attendance and kids that would come to school late. And the attendance clerk every week would give me a list of the top 10 offenders. And my job was to go and talk to them and try and get them to come to school on time and to come to school more often. And so the way I was trained, I'd go pull them out of class, pull them down to my office, and we'd have a conversation about why they were late and the importance of coming to school. And I mean, that's a little bit like saying, pull out your textbooks, we're going to learn about graphing. Like, how that experience doesn't want to make that kid come to school more often. That experience, me calling that family and saying, hey, like your kid comes to school late a lot. Like, how can we help you get your kid here on time? Like, that doesn't make the families want to connect with the school. It's this annoying phone call from some guy that we don't know to go to some place that we don't want to come. So getting the school garden stuff, it's like to be able to call those families and say, hey, I've been working with your kid in the garden a lot, and I just want to let you know that they're really good at this stuff. And like, if there's any opportunity to garden at home, let's help you out. Let's get you some seeds and soil. But they really enjoy doing this stuff at school, and it's really great. That phone call feels a lot different than the, hey, you bring your kids to school late too often. Like, you need to get them here on time.
Yeah. It's less punishing. It's less embarrassing to the parent.
But you're also creating a school culture and climate that the kids want to be there because they're doing something that they connect with, that they enjoy, and it's something that they don't necessarily associate that with school. Like, to come to a school to see the chickens or feed the chickens early, you know, or to come to the garden to see what's happening in the garden, or you come early and you get to, you know, water some plants. Like, it intrinsically makes the kids want to go instead of grown-ups that often don't live in those communities telling you that you got to come.
So a very specific sort of question. I'll get to Robin in a second, who's been waiting to get on. When do they actually work in the garden? Before school? After school? Is it open any time? Is it supervised? So that people don't, you know, cut themselves on this or that? Or how does that work?
They're always out there with someone, but it's different at every school. No school anyway is the same as any other school. They might have the same curriculum because it's expected by the state of Arizona. In some schools, as at Monzo, the students have chores, farm chores, and they go out and do chores at different times of the day based on when their teacher wants to release them to do those chores. So some students are doing composting, some students are taking care of the chickens, some students are watering the plants. But when the interns come from the university, they're taking small groups of students out from a regular class and focusing on what the teacher is doing in that class and emphasizing that, so that the students who have a hard time listening or who are not English speakers can go outside and do rather than just listen and try to understand what's going on by listening. So students are always, the children are always supervised when they go out into the garden. But they're often going out for different reasons, everything from taking care of chickens to doing a math kind of assignment by measuring out the plots where they're going to put the seeds that day.
Robin?
So what we know in this world of teaching to the test is this is an opportunity. One of the things we have in Arizona and every other state is that we are testing our kids constantly. And the results of those tests, most times you don't even need to give the kid a test. You don't need to test every kid in every school because test scores are heavily reliant on family income and family education. So there is a guy who says, you know, you don't need to give the test. Just tell me what, you know, the family's income is and I can give you the test score. You know, why bother? But what research says, so that's a political solution, but research says is project-based learning, students actually doing activity, ingrains it in their minds, helps them learn. And so all of these schools, as you said in the beginning, we're in Title I schools that struggle financially. And this is a wonderful, I happen to have a small relationship with one of the schools that has one. My daughter and used to teach there and two of my grandchildren went to school there. And it is amazing, but there's also, if you could address like food security, because I know at the school my daughter taught at, they had a sale on Thursday afternoons. They had a farmer's market and they would sell things, but you could get like Brussels sprouts, 100 of them for 25 cents, and families would come. It was helpful for their providing food for their family, and the kids loved it to have this empowering thing of, I am helping bring home not the bacon, but the Brussels sprouts or the eggs or the dirt, the compost.
So some of the schools do have markets. Davis, Drockman, Monzo Elementary has a market, and Moses started the market there. So maybe you can talk a little bit more about it.
Yeah, I would say it's a food security thing, but also I think that one thing that's really important that the garden does is it gives the kids agency. In like a real way. And so
agency meaning
like they do real stuff. Mm-hmm. Like they're not pretending. And so like as a counselor, we are trained to do career development, but that career development in the traditional sense is like you bring in a firefighter, a cop, a doctor, whatever, to talk to the kids about what they do. And then you have those costumes and the kids dress up and like play scenarios, but it's all fake. There's no consequence. The garden is a very consequential place. Like you do the work well and you grow things. You don't do the work well and things die. And so I think that giving the kids agency is so powerful. And when you run a farmer's market, that agency involves money and money handling. And that's doesn't get more real world than that, but it makes
and math skills.
And math skills.
And math skills, and also business skills. Our students at a couple of our schools, they're selling their produce to restaurants. And so they're learning how to predict the harvest. How much do they have to grow? At what points will they have that produce be able to be harvested and taken to the restaurant for consumption. So they learn how to make business transactions with these various restaurants.
Yeah. Write invoices, sort produce mm-hmm. for A quality, B quality, and C quality produce, and where that make the decisions on where that produce goes.
So you're up to 24 schools, which is absolutely amazing. I mean, the proof is in the pudding, or in the garden, so to speak, and the proof here is that it's up to 24 schools. Was it that you went to schools or that schools heard about it and came to you?
So the history for me was, it's different from what it was for Moses, but for me it was the Obama administration at the beginning of the Great Recession gave out a lot of money across the country. And one of the big grants that they gave out was Communities Putting Prevention to Work. That big bucket of money, the food bank got a bit of it, and they started doing prevention work against obesity, diabetes, and smoking cessation. And one of the ways they decided to try to affect that was through gardens, residential gardens and school gardens. So they installed gardens at a number of schools, and the teachers were excited about it. There's a movement already across the country to have gardens at schools and to use those gardens for learning. And a student came to me, Morgan Apicella, and said, hey, I want to work at this school, Project Moore. And there, this food bank is interested in having somebody there who could facilitate that. And he said, can I do an independent study on that? And I said, okay, let's do it. And then the food bank finds out I'm doing an independent study with one person, and they say, can you do a few more people? So it turns out that there's a lot of students who want to work in gardens. And there's six students the next semester. And then the next semester, there's 17 students. And then the next semester, it's a lot of independent studies. So I turn it into a class with the permission of my department head and start literally training them as a group on how to go out and support a garden. That would be doing, implementing a plan, putting the plants into the ground, learning about infrastructure, irrigations, et cetera. But also, soon after we kind of figured out how to maintain a garden, we said, well, what else can we do? Let's see if we can use a garden to teach. We know that it's an effective space for doing that. And so by 2019, we have about 50 to 60 interns each semester. So that's about 100 to 120 interns every year. And they go from undergraduates to, freshmen up to PhD students.
You're listening to Smart Talk, KVOI, 1030 on your dial. This just came up on the screen. Was I supposed to read this or what? It's not exactly clear, but we're learning radio as we go along here. When you talk about this, the way it grew and added one thing to another thing to another thing, were you initially, what got you into gardening? And it sounds like you, to train these students, you had yourself to have been
a gardener. We rely on a lot of community partners. I had a garden. I wouldn't call myself a gardener. I think that would have dignified my ignorance in a way that I didn't deserve. But we learned to reach out to other people and say, well, you know a lot about gardening. Can you come in and talk to this class? This was before we had an initiative on campus to do engagement. And then when the engagement stuff came, I was kind of ahead of the curve on that, and I realized that there was resources then available for me to take advantage of. The Green Fund became available through the university, and that's a fund that is available to undergraduates. It's got a fee attached to it, a sustainability fee, and the students, undergraduate students, can apply to make their campus more sustainable.
We're going to take a break, so stick with us as we're going to ask both Sally and Moses about how you can get involved, where the garden program is going to go next, and whether this thing may spread across Arizona and even be national.
Do it.
All right, we're back on the air, and as I said, we're now going to talk about how you can get involved and where the program is going in the future, and what aspirations these two pioneers in gardening as a way to keep kids in school and keep engagement and actually learn things going. Guys, what would you like to see in the future? What do you think is going to happen?
Okay, I think we can answer that question, but I'd like to answer something that you left us with at the break, and that is, how is this thing going to grow? What's it going to look like? And in fact, we're already national and international. I'm going to pick up somebody from Scotland at the airport today, and he's going to spend a week with us looking about how to do this sort of thing in a low-income school that he is near his university in Glasgow. We are asked yearly to participate in a school garden support organization's workshops. And we do two conferences here in Tucson and also in collaboration with ASU, where sometimes it's here, sometimes it's up in Tempe, where we train teachers to use gardens. And we train teachers once a month through the Green Academy also to use gardens in the Tucson Unified School District. But we have other teachers sometimes coming up from Sierra Vista and other places to participate in that. So we are already local, regional, national, and international. What I think is our biggest challenge in the gardens is less kind of keeping them running in the sense of our own expertise to be able to do that. It's having adequate support to do that. Basically, the university provides salary money, but what all the rest of the money that we raise goes to the Tucson Unified School District. So most of our budget it comes through the university, and we make it available for teachers through stipends, materials, building new gardens, sending our program coordinators to professional development so they're on top of what's the latest in school garden practices. So we can always use, every year we raise money. We have to raise between right now $300,000 and $400,000 a year to keep the program going. And so people can help with money. That's probably our biggest need.
Contact for making contributions.
The best way to find us is on schoolgardensarizona.edu, and there is a donate click a button on the page, and you can just click there, and it'll tell you exactly what you need to do to donate.
And is it a big donate button, or is it hard to find? Is it on the right top?
I'm not sure. I looked at it yesterday, though, and it's not hard to find.
Okay, you guys, I'm going to look it up. You guys continue.
Schoolgardens.arizona.edu.
And if you want to find out more about us, just put that into your search browser, and we will be the first thing that comes up when you put schoolgardens.arizona.edu.
Fantastic.
And what would it what does it cost for one school? Because I know you have schools coming in that or schools that want to be a part of it, and there's not enough funding. So let's say a school approached you, and you would need. Have you ever figured out how much you need for each school?
Yeah, this is a part of my job with the Tucson Unified okay. School District. I go out weekly to schools that want to launch new gardens. And the building the garden is the easy part. And I would say that a well-funded startup garden, you know, maybe $2,000 or $3,000 could launch the infrastructure. But the more difficult part is the human resources and the capacity that school can build around that garden to keep, you know, kids engaged with it and to keep it functioning over the long haul. That's the tricky part.
So small donations and large donations are all welcome.
Absolutely.
Let me throw out a question that would go for you guys, including Robin. What do you think that, maybe this goes to Robin first, what do you think the chances are that the success of this program could eventually get picked up by or funded by the state of Arizona? That is, it's a booming thing. You've mostly done it on your own time. I was talking with Sally earlier. She has a full-time job at the U. I mean, it's a lot of work. It seems to have a lot of success. Is it something that the state should invest in? Robin?
Well, the problem is we are either 49th or 48th in per pupil spending, depending on which list you're looking at. And the state does not give money without requiring something of you. And so they might say, yes, we'll fund this, but we also want this, this, and this to happen. You can only grow certain kinds of vegetables too. We will have a test at the end of the year about it. So I think it's better that it not come from the state, just because right now the district and the college are running this. And so there's a lot more freedom than if the state gets involved in it. And that's why it would be important for people to go to the website, which is schoolgardens.arizona.edu. The donate word is on the right top between directory and contact us. It's very small. It's in red letters. It's not easily recognizable, but it's right above a child holding a raspberry. And so if people are interested in supporting this, they should. It's a great project. It helps on all sorts of levels. While I was looking up stuff about gardening and things, there is a lot of research done in urban areas about the importance for social emotional learning, and also it how it benefits children in feeling not only more comfortable with themselves, but less stress in their lives. And so this is a huge gift for the students and for the schools, and we should all be supporting it.
You know, a thought I just had, I know the U uses this and other things too, but whether you could have naming rights for the gardens, that someone, often at the university, we found out that folks like to give money for buildings, brick and mortar, because their name will go on it forever. But just to give money for faculty salaries or things like that, that seems invisible, but that it's the Johnson or the Ferguson building. Oh, they love that. So you could imagine having naming for a garden, a little plaque, or even sections of the garden. So, you know, the Al and Robin tomato section or the...
Yes, and we're going to make a donation, but it's just for that year. It's not ongoing unless it's a huge endowment.
Yes. Oh, smart. Very smart. I like that. Absolutely. She's been at fundraising a lot more than I have, and that's really...
But it should be supported. I think it would be better if you got the County Board of Supervisors or the City of Tucson to help with it.
Can I chime in on the state funding question? I think that what we need is the state of Arizona to fully fund public education and not school gardens. Because when I started the garden program at Monzo in 2006, we had a full-time PE teacher, a full-time art teacher, a full-time computer teacher, and I was a full-time counselor. And so what all of us did, because we could provide enrichment, when we were providing enrichment to those classrooms, the teachers got planning time. All of that is gone now. And there is no planning time during the school day for teachers. And so what that makes it really hard for teachers to engage in the garden because they're full up and overstretched with all of the requirements that they have. And so if they had a little bit of breathing room during the school day and there was more staff to take on the workload that's there, then there's more room to engage in the garden. And all of those people, the art teacher, the PE teacher, and the computer teacher, I collaborated with those folks and they were doing garden integration. I wasn't just doing the gardens alone, but this was access points for the kids. The kids during PE time were coming out and building the gardens. The kids during computer time were doing research about what we were growing. The art teacher was doing art integration with the kids out in the garden. And because the state of Arizona has defunded public education, all that stuff is gone and makes our work in the schools really hard.
You know, another thought is the Tucson Festival of Books. And I don't think any of us thought this would ever go anywhere. And it's now the third or fourth largest book festival in the United States. And it is managed by massive numbers of volunteers. And another thought is whether retirees or other folks just who want to contribute could also be part of the garden program, which of course raises the question, do they need the training or some kind of certification before you can turn people loose in the garden? Or does the school district require something rather than just having folks who want to volunteer and show up?
Can I just add something?
Thank you.
So volunteers are great, but you still need a staff person at the school to do it, to manage it. It can't be people just walking into the school and saying, I'm going to hang out in the garden. Are there any kids available? And I'll walk them over. It's public education is a public good, and we need to fund it so that it works for students and for everyone. And that is the priority. And the best people to work for with students, although an older person is always really wonderful, like myself, but is to be able to have the freedom. So let's say there is a volunteer. They're already volunteers. There are people who are students. But what you want is to build the infrastructure that would allow that. And right now, to have that infrastructure, we need, as Moses said, to fully fund public schools. In our school, might not have happened yours, but a lot of schools have lost librarians, counselors. I'm always shocked to see there's a counselor in an elementary school. Well done, Monzo. But our schools are underfunded, and teachers are being stretched to the max. Anyway, so that's what we need to do first, and then perhaps expand it to volunteers.
That sounds totally reasonable. I express my ignorance completely of the more you talk, the more I realize, my God, all the security things and everything else, given how conscious we are of everything from, oh my God, with kids, it's blah, 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 to have something open for anyone to show up. Thank you for correcting me on that. Sally, you look like you're about ready to say something.
Well, we don't have much time till the break, but do you want me to hold on to it till then?
John, are we ready to take a break? Okay, let's go to break and hang on. Sally's going to get back with
you
something
important. You want to give the phone number? Pardon? You haven't given them the phone number?
Oh, yeah, my God. Please, it's a little late, but call in 790-2040. 790-2040. Talking about the University of Arizona Community and School Garden Program with Moses Thompson and Sally Marston. Sally, we're getting near the end of the show here. So are there some sum up things and some conclusions and punchlines you'd like to tell us?
Actually, a few things. This is a successful program, and it's a wonderful, a rewarding program for the students at the university who are evaluating their experience of the course at the end of the semester. Will always say, I learned more than I taught. This has been very important to me. I became a person who understands community. I understand how I can play a role in community in the future. It's an empowering thing for them. They also learn skills that they don't learn in class, like real problems. Irrigation is broken. What are we going to do now? How do we fix this? Really practical and immediate problems that they will have to address in their careers as they move forward. So I'll say the program is a success in that way. It's a success that we're able to reach this many students, or this many schools, and the students in those schools and the teachers. But we ourselves are at capacity. We are those people who are stretched thin as well. And so I just want to say that we have a waiting list for schools. If you are interested in having support from us, we will put you on a waiting list. We aren't going to be able to come right out to your school and help you to put a garden in right away. We don't do that in the summer anyway. It's not good for the plants.
No, or for us to be out there. Ingrid, we have a caller. Ingrid, you're on the air.
Hi. I called in a little earlier, but I guess your board wasn't open yet. Having to do with what's actually learned when children are gardening. And there's a lot of botany and chemistry involved in that. And that can start at a very young age. For instance, photosynthesis can be taken up with young children, and they learn that what's going on with the plant involves sugar, the production of sugar and oxygen, and that happens in the presence of sunlight. There's chemistry in there. And you can sort of sneak in these things if you want to look at it that way, or just openly say, well, we're going to study a little botany and chemistry while we're here in the garden and learn about the composition of the soil and what's under the earth, and that brings in other topics. And taking children into a garden, I think, is a wonderful thing.
We're so lucky to have this program here.
Yeah. You know, Ingrid, let me ask our guests here how much of these chemistry and other more technical things that we've got to remember also we're dealing with elementary school, grades 1, 2, 3, 4, up through high school. How much of the stuff is snuck in?
It's not really snuck in.
Pardon me?
Yeah, it's actually literally part of the curriculum. We've developed curriculum for the Desert Southwest. It's appropriate to the region that we're in. And so the kinds of standardized learning that they're doing in the classroom is expanded out into the world when they come out into the garden. So, Ingrid, you're absolutely right about the power of a garden to do all kinds of education, science, social science, literacy. It's appropriate for any kind of learning, and students do learn that stuff. And when students come back to the classroom and say, who are maybe second graders, and they're saying photosynthesis, it's that they really understand it because they've been studying it for a few weeks. They've seen the plant change. They understand that. And we do this in part through STEM education work that we're doing, where we partner with a scientist at the university, and the children participate in that scientist project. We also do it by one of our program coordinators who works directly with teachers and students, teaching them the scientific method, and that includes not just science in the conventional way of understanding, but also social science. So asking questions, formulating hypotheses, collecting data, analyzing the data, and coming up with a kind of response to the question that they asked at the beginning of that scientific process.
Moses?
Yeah, I've got a 4-year-old that's at a TUSD Early Learning Center that works in the garden and has an intern from Sally's class in the garden, Miss Hannah. And just the other day, I was making him cereal and pouring him almond milk. And he's like, almond milk? He's like, Miss Hannah told me that almonds grow on trees. And so here he is, a 4-year-old, making the connection from this white liquid coming out of a carton to the natural world and realizing that, what he's consuming and where it comes from. And I think that's a really powerful thing. And I think a lot of people are disconnected from where the food comes and how nature plays a role in that. And earlier you had said that remember that these are just elementary school students. I know elementary school students that could teach you about the nitrogen cycle and tell you about how bacteria digest ammonia, and that the bacteria, then the byproduct is nitrates and nitrites that plants can digest. Like I know elementary school kids that know that stuff.
Thank God for my ignorance. It's provided a great without a dummy like me, this has provided a great format for people to come out and
you got to come and see the gardens. Yeah,
I got to come out and see the gardens, and I got to upgrade on these things that that I know about. Robin, you got an announcement you'd like to sneak in sometime. Why don't you do it right now?
Okay. So this Monday at 5:30, the newly formed Education Policy Center in the College of Ed, which was just approved by the people who approve things at the University of Arizona, is presenting a conversation, a lecture. It's by the two people who head the Civil Rights Project at UCLA, and it's the name of the lecture is Civil Rights and Education in the Trump Era. And it is Monday, April 29th at 5:30 to 7 p.m. And it's in the Integrated Learning Center, which is the underground place at the U of A, right in front of Modern Languages. And you go down the stairs. And anyway, it's Monday, April 29th, 5:30 to 7 p.m. The speakers are Patricia Galandara and Gary Orfield, and they are fantastic. It's going to be a really exciting thing. We hope you'll join us. It's, again, called Civil Rights and Education in the Trump Era. Thanks, Al.
So I have a question for Robin, if I may. One of the things that we've been thinking about over the years of this program, which, as I said at the beginning, is now getting close to its 10th year. I mean, it's finishing its 10th year. And that is, what if we actually, we can't get, what if we, short of actually adequately funding education, what if we had a policy where teachers had one class in their educational, in their college of education experience where they learned garden-based learning and they learned how to teach it? That would be a major step towards us being able to support the gardens without having to have special training sessions. We still could have the special training sessions as even, we'd still be able to do that, but we wouldn't, we would have a person who came to their first year of teaching and they already were excited about using a garden. They knew how to do it. They could prepare their lesson plans. Can you ever imagine that happening in the state of Arizona?
Or in the College of Education.
Or, I'm just saying anywhere, even in the United States, if it couldn't happen in the U.S.
I think it's a great idea. I used to have this person who worked for the organization I worked for, Voices for Education, and they, she was from the University of North Carolina, and every undergraduate was required to take a class in public education, which is the ins and outs, how it works, why it's important to fund it, what kinds of things has research said. So I think it's a great idea. I'm going to bring it up.
Excellent. Excellent.
And we've introduced a new concept, which I've never heard of, and which I love, garden-based learning.
Oh, it's like a thing.
It really is.
It's only new to you, Al. We should have
We're going to have you guys back again.
Look at all the things it does. Building community, math, art, STEM, learning about the natural world. It covers everything.
Fantastic. The Education of Al Bergerson. We got a new name for the show to have you do it. I see on one of your things on the web that Manzo,
yeah.
Is your flagship model. Is it possible, or should I even say this, that people can go out and take a look at just to see how it's going? What's the appropriate thing for me to say, and I'm going to have you say it, about if they want to actually take a peek or something? Should they contact the school first? Or
I think maybe contact us on that schoolgardens.arizona.edu. You could use the contact button to contact us.
We'll get the message.
Yeah, and then we can set up a tour. We do tours of folks through Manzo all the time. It's really a powerful experience. We have student tour guides, and so you don't have to listen to us talk. You get to listen to elementary school kids talk.
Oh, that's fifth graders. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I love that. We have school guides. Robin?
Again, I think that I just want to put a push in for the donations, because if we want this program to expand.
Money.
TUSD is a very poor district in a very poor state, and then we underfund things by giving away $13.2 billion in tax credits every year. And but to have people underwrite, I think, would be a wonderful idea. And instead of a naming right, how about if they're invited to lunch once a year where they eat food from the garden
that
kids have picked? And so, again, that website is schoolgardens.arizona.edu. And it is a wonderful thing.
It's a fantastic.
And if anyone's ever been in a garden, and it's what is also nice is a lot of our schools are look like deserts, not deserts with desert plantings, but they're blank. They're, old dead grass. And this is a way for kids to actually dig in the dirt and to find out things, in addition to learning all these wonderful things they're learning.
I agree.
It's, yeah. It's amazing. I must say, I read some of the stuff online, but just talking with you guys, I had no idea. There was an article in the local paper, and it had said 19 schools, and Sally corrected me and said 24. So it's growing. But you guys are getting close to feeling maxed out, both financially and your time and effort. So, folks, if you've got any ideas for helping or want to directly contribute, please check out their website,
schoolgardens.arizona.edu.
Schoolgardens.arizona.edu. We're down to a short bit of time here. Anyone want to sum up and have some last things to say? That's we can go around the room. Moses?
I think that I really underestimated how magical school gardens could be, that really they get the kids excited to come to school. They engage with families. They are a great place for kids to reinforce what they're learning inside the classroom walls. We've seen them transform school climate and school culture.
I'm going to jump in with one myself. We can go this way. It would be great for someone in the ed school or even in social and behavioral science to do a study of retention rates or showing up on time in schools with gardens and schools without gardens, along with the study you've already done of what they say they feel better, but to actually show that having a garden really makes a huge difference. We're down to 1 minute. I'm getting the cues from everyone.
Okay.
I'm doing okay. We're doing okay here.
No eye contact.
All right. Sally, Robin, you got anything last to say? 51 seconds.
We need to fully fund schools. We're right now back. Even if all of the proposals that happen right now, we would only be back to 2007 levels. Other states are investing in schools and they're doing much better economically. No one wants to come to a school that doesn't invest in future workers.
No one
wants to come to a state.
I can hear the music coming up. I want to thank my guests, Moses Thompson from the U of A and TUSD, and Sally Marsden, a professor of geography at the University of Arizona, and of course, my co-host, and when she's running it, I'm her co-host, Robin Hiller. For Smart Talk, this is Al Bergeson. We're out. See you next Saturday.
Thanks, Al.
Thank you.
Thanks, Al. Bye-bye.